all for joining our call today with a special Washington update. I am Jill Orlando, Relationship Manager with the Chance Mantillon Group. Before we begin, just a few housekeeping items. Everyone is currently muted. If you would like to ask a question during the call, please email it to thechancemantillongroup@ubs.com. We will be monitoring that email throughout the call. Now I would like to turn the call over to Andrew Chance to begin our discussion.
Thank you very much, Jill, and thanks to everyone joining us today. Apologies, we had a couple of technical issues this morning. I think it has to do with me. My iPhone completely died this morning and had to get a new one, so it's been a technology day. So thank you for putting up with us a little bit. Once again, extraordinarily happy to have John Savercool with us. John heads our Office of Public Policy down in D.C. for UBS. These are John's work and his team's work continues to be the most requested research that we have, which is an interesting fact for an investment firm. But everybody wants to know what's happening in Washington, and there's no shortage of opportunities for questions that we have to ask for John. So John, I'm going to thank you in advance. I know we'll try and keep this at a reasonable length of time. You know, once I get going, sometimes these are a little difficult to slow down. But we've got some questions that have been sent in. As Jill let us know, there's going to be an opportunity for people to send questions to the Chance Mantillon Group at UBS.com. And I guess the first thing I would ask, just give you kind of an open question. There's, you know, as I said, so much client interest in what happens in Washington. What are the most important things that you see happening in Washington, D.C. right now?
Hi, Andrew. Nice to be with you and everyone else today. It's been a while since we've gotten together to do this, so I really appreciate being with you today. As always, there's a lot happening in Washington. This is the start of a new year. This is the second half of the 117th Congress. And most importantly, from the standpoint of looking at the schedule, it's important to note that this is an election year, and election years are typically light on legislative activities. Lawmakers tend to become a little more defensive and a little more risk averse, and they spend more time at home. So there's not as much time in Washington to pass bills. And this year will probably be the same. So it'll be very front loaded in January and February. The two biggest things that Democrats will try to advance, and I say Democrats because they're the majority party in the House and Senate. There's a voting rights bill on the Senate floor today, and that will likely not pass. And then the Democrats will seek to make some changes to the Senate rules, particularly the filibuster, and that will likely not pass either. So that'll be the activity of this week, maybe spilling into next week. And really, the focus after that will be on passing a government spending bill, which has to be done. You know, we're already 5 months into the fiscal year, and the government doesn't have a spending bill specific to this year, using the same budget from last year. And so they'll have to do that in mid-February. And then the President Biden's Build Back Better legislation will be the subject of Senate negotiations. They really haven't started yet, but my guess is in February and March, we'll see that heat up. And that's the big bill, the big spending bill that will be offset in part by tax increases. So this is probably the biggest risk to investors and to our clients is probably the composition of this bill if it moves forward. And there's no guarantee that it will move forward, but it is a priority for Democrats. And even though there have been a couple of senators who we've heard about who oppose certain provisions or the basic construct, there still is a lot of Democratic support to get this done before the election to put points on the board. This will be a very active topic in February, March, maybe April.
There's a tremendous amount to unpack there. I'm going to leave that. There's a lot to talk about on the Build Back Better, so I'm going to let that one sit for just a few minutes. You mentioned where we are with the Congress, and I believe this afternoon, or maybe even now, President Biden is going to be talking or speaking, and we're a year in here. And overall, how do you think the president would rate himself, and how do you think the country is rating the first year here?
So we're 1 year in. The president will have a press conference today at 4 o'clock. So that'll be a pretty significant event in that this is only his second press conference he's done since he's been president. You know, we'll see how he does. We'll see what he reports on. I think it will be kind of a preview of some of the things he'll talk about in his State of the Union address, which will be on March 1. So he'll talk about the pandemic, efforts that the administration has made to increase testing, increase vaccines, things like that. I'm sure he'll talk about the bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed. He'll talk about his COVID bill that passed. So he will use his time to talk about what he sees as the accomplishments of this administration. I think if you look at public polling, where his approval rating is somewhere about 43% on average, and most polls show him in the low 40s. There's been one poll that showed him lower than 40%, and there's been a couple polls that have shown him a little higher in the mid-40s. But by and large, his standing is not particularly high with the American public as outlined in these polls. You know, this is not particularly uncommon. Trump was in the low 40s in most of his administration. Obama was not particularly high in the second half of his first term. So every president, maybe not every president, but this is not unusual. It's a tough time to be president. There's a lot to do, a lot of challenges. I think that right now, the president is not in a great political position to make demands or to lead his party in a unified way on every issue. So along with the diminished polling in the unfavorable ratings that are higher than the favorable ratings, comes with it a loss of capital, a loss of political power that will certainly limit his agenda.
Well, that's interesting. When I think about what you had said, sort of the action for Congress will be in the front 2 months in January and February, and then it sort of trickles off as people go and prepare for those midterm elections. And with the president not having a lot of pull, we'll put aside the voting rights and the filibuster changes or Senate rule changes, I guess we would say. In terms of that Build Back Better, there's particularly one or two senators who've kind of kiboshed it in the beginning. Is there really enough time for him to get something major like that done?
Well, there is enough time. The elections are not for another 300 days. The president and the Congress have about 6 months to legislate. Once we hit our summer vacations, Washington will pretty much shut down. They will be in session in September, but they won't get much done in September. People will be itching to get back home and campaign. So if anything is going to get done, it's going to happen certainly by July 4. Anything after that is probably not going to happen. Build Back Better, if it's not done by April 1, which happens to be my birthday, then I think it probably won't be done. Democrats have momentum right now, but they'll lose it if there's no bill by April 1. I think Democrats will be ready to move on to a different issue. Who knows what the world will look like on April 1. There may be new challenges, new opportunities, new ways for Democrats, you know, new policy priorities that Democrats are focused on. So April 1, I think, to me, is a good date to look at. If Build Back Better is not done by then, it probably won't be done. So they have a few months to get it done.
You know, you had mentioned, obviously, this consumed a tremendous amount of our brain power in the middle of last year, and before all of a sudden it didn't, right? It was everything that we were talking about for probably 6 or 8 weeks. The biggest things that folks were obviously concerned about were changes in capital gains taxes, possible changes in estate taxes, and then, you know, major dramatic changes to transfer taxes. For example, talking about removal of the step up in cost basis, that caused a lot of concern, obviously, for pretty much everybody. And then to a lesser degree, the SALT, the state and local tax issues. Are you guys hearing anything? You said this is obviously, there's negotiations ongoing. Has anybody put out any kind of positions to say which ones there, you know, are they definitely want to have in there for either side, or definitely doesn't want to have in there for either side? Is there any sense we can give to our clients on that?
Yes. And, you know, I remember working with you and Tom and others, these tax provisions back in the fall. I mean, that was all we were talking about as the House put together its bill and eventually passed its bill. But once the Senate started to work on the bill, the composition of the bill completely changed. So most of the changes that you just referenced, the increase in the capital gains tax, the increase in the corporate rate, the increase in the exemption amount, Oh, I'm sorry, the lowering of the exemption amount in the estate tax, the elimination of step-up basis, all those things are now out of the bill. Out of the bill. and they very likely will not return. So there's good news on that front. And for that, we have Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, to thank. She put her foot down and said that the House's tax provisions were not acceptable to her, and she didn't like them, and she wouldn't vote for the bill if they were in there. And that has forced Senate Democrats to write new tax provisions in the bill that's being negotiated now. And those tax provisions don't really look like the provisions from the House bill. They include things like the only tax on individuals that might be of note to people would be a surtax of 5% on annual income over $10 million a year. Then there's an additional surtax on income over $25 million a year. The other tax increases are primarily on the corporate side, and they relate to the imposition of a corporate minimum tax and the taxation of the foreign earnings of U.S. companies. So that is primarily the tax chapter of the Senate bill that is being negotiated now. And frankly, there isn't a lot of opposition to those provisions. Senator Sinema has not expressed opposition to them, neither has Senator Joe Manchin. So if there is a Build Back Better bill that emerges from the Senate, those tax provisions will likely prevail, not the earlier tax provisions that we spoke about, the increase in the capital gains tax, the state tax provisions, step-up basis. All those are now out of the bill. There will be, there very likely will be a SALT provision in the bill, and that will be because the leader of the Senate is Chuck Schumer from New York. There's a gang of about 15 or 20 Democrats in the House who won't vote for a bill unless it has some kind of SALT relief in it. So there has to be SALT relief in the bill, but I think it will be very modest. I think it will be an expansion of the $10,000 deduction amount that exists today. Maybe it'll go up to 15. Maybe it will go up to 18, something like that. It won't be a widespread elimination of the cap. That's just too expensive. And I don't think it will pass muster in the Senate. So I do think that there will be modest SALT relief in any bill if a bill does evolve.
Do you think that would also be subject to an income cap? I'd heard that going around a little bit as well. So they're only going to raise it so much, but if you're making over $400,000, $500,000 a year, you're kind of out of luck.
That's what many Democrats in the Senate would like to do. I think that's still an open question. The last conversations I've heard were about a week ago, and they're focused on just expanding the cap. No one has come up with a plan that works, that has an income limit on who can take the higher deduction. But yeah, there are a handful of Democrats who would like to do that. So that is still in play, still hasn't been resolved. And frankly, Andrew, this won't be really publicized until the last minute. Democrats are kind of embarrassed by this provision because they want tax relief for citizens of their states, but they know that if they provide generous relief, it's going to help wealthier people, and that's not their aim through this legislation. So they're sensitive to that criticism, and this will probably be the provision that is decided last and won't be announced until after all the others.
This is as good a place as any to, you know, maybe briefly circle back. In terms of the government spending bill, you said we've been operating with it without one for 5 months or so, and the costs associated with that, as well as the costs of Build Back Better. My first question on the spending bill is, what is keeping that held up? And the second question is one that I know you get a lot, we continue to get a lot. It's a perennial favorite. Does anyone in Washington really care about how big the national debt gets? You can answer those in any order that you'd like.
Yes, this is a bill to fund the government from in fiscal year 23, which runs from October 1 of last year to the end of September of this year. So there isn't a budget yet. And as we mentioned, you know, we're 4 or 5 months or 3 months into that new fiscal year. So the disagreement is over whether priority in this budget should be given to domestic spending or defense spending. And this is always the fight that Republicans and Democrats have every year. Democrats have proposed to increase domestic spending by 14%. That's in the Biden budget for this year, or proposed budget. Republicans want to raise defense spending by 5%. In the Biden budget, the defense increases is in between 1 and 2%. So how they narrow their differences between Democrats wanting a 14% increase in domestic spending, which Republicans have a hard time with, and the Republican insistence that you raise defense spending by 5%, which most Democrats have a problem with, they have to narrow that difference. So theoretically, you could look at it and say, okay, well, let's increase both by 8%. You know, that pushes defense up a little bit. It lowers domestic a little bit, and you know that's halfway for both sides. So something like that might work. Typically, the solution is that Republicans and Democrats will get more of what they want rather than less of what they want. And what that means is just more spending, not offset by tax increases. So it's an increase to the deficit every year. And I suspect that that is how this will be resolved in mid-February, when it has to be resolved. If it's not resolved, Republicans are not unhappy if you just have another extension of last year's funding, because last year's funding will be less than this year's projected spending. So the impact on the deficit is not as strong, and Republicans are happy with that. And so we'll see those dynamics play out over the next couple of weeks. But no one in Washington, well, not no one, but not enough people are concerned about the deficit to really make it a priority. I mean, Republicans and Democrats both give lip service to the deficit and how damaging it is and how our grandchildren are going to have to pay the deficit and how it will burden them. But the reality is that most members don't really have the courage to vote for the spending decreases or the tax increases that are needed to lower the deficit. This is a politician's worst job, is to have to cut spending or increase taxes. They hate to do it, but that's what they're going to have to do to lower the deficit, unless they can major changes to the so-called entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and find savings in those programs that will allow for a lowering of the deficit. And that's hard to do, because you're potentially, by making changes, you're likely going to be cutting some benefits and raising some taxes that people pay into the system. That's not really popular either, although it may be necessary. And politicians don't like to alienate the most powerful voters in America, which are older voters who utilize these programs. So this is a tough issue, and I don't think Congress will get serious about reducing the deficit until they really look at Social Security and Medicare. There are a couple of timelines that are coming up in a couple of years. There are certain parts of Social Security and Medicare that have to be tweaked, and maybe Congress will take that opportunity to get into the programs and make some other adjustments that might impact the deficit. I hope that'll happen in 2025. If it does, that'll probably be the next time that Congress gets serious about cutting the deficit.
Yeah, I would imagine that's that doesn't make for a really good campaign slogan, cutting benefits and increasing taxes. That's pretty hard to run on that one, I think. And, right. You know, I remember a presentation that you did way back after Obama's first election back in our old headquarters in Stanford, where you talked exactly about the demographics in this country favoring people that want more social services, and that was going to be a bit of a tailwind for a while. So seems like that's still the case.
And, you know, keep in mind, some of these programs Americans pay into. I mean, you and I and others on the call have paid into Social Security. We paid into Medicare. So everyone should get something back from those. But the reality is that when these programs were created, it was assumed that people would have an average lifespan of 70 years old or 72, and then they would depart. And now people are living until they're 100 or older, and they're utilizing Social Security and Medicare up until that age. So it's not anyone's fault necessarily. It's just the reality of our demographics and our increased lifestyle, which is great. But we just need to adjust these programs to recognize that and to take those longer lifespans into account. So hopefully this can all be done. It makes sense that it gets done. I don't think anyone would disagree that it needs to get done, but Congress has to find the courage to do it and tell people that either taxes are going to have to be increased or spending is going to have to be cut, or a combination of both will have to bring the spending more in line with the actual reality of the programs and its ability to provide benefits.
As the readers of our Saturday Note know, I crossed the line and got my AARP card in the mail the other day when I turned 50. So now I'm more keenly focused on the Social Security aspect of things. It also makes me think about, you know, I see so many clients who are dialed in here, and everyone kind of chuckles when we look at our financial goal analysis and our plans. And there's that final dot that says, your plan ends. So that's the one we're talking about there on the back end.
It's always this moment to get that AARP card. It reminds you how old. I hope you saved it.
I hear there's great discounts, so I'm excited to get involved there. I do want to spend just a few minutes talking about the Fed and what we see rapidly kind of unfolding in the past couple of days. So I'm sure everyone's aware, you know, the Fed was talking about the transitory nature of inflation, and there was a, quote, hawkish shift, and now they're much more focused on inflation. They're much more fluid. Depending on who you want to listen to, we're looking at somewhere between 2 and 5 interest rate increases next year. I think we're probably in the camp for 3 raises of 25 basis points each. So when is Powell's reconfirmation process complete? Is there any chance for an upset in there at this point in time? Is there anybody who's going to object to that, or is he pretty much the person that they want?
He had a confirmation hearing last week. Once the Senate dispenses with its vote here on the voting rights bill this week, we could see a nomination vote on Powell as early as next week. I don't think there will be an upset. I think he clearly has bipartisan support. I suspect he'll get about 80 votes, which is a lot for a Fed chairman. There will be a couple of people who oppose him. I mean, there always are. And, you know, someone will focus on some issues, why they don't find him acceptable. But I think the strong majority of the Senate supports him. And he will be confirmed, you know, unless some scandalous story bubbles up over the next week. I think he's a shoo-in. You know, frankly, he's done a good job in terms of keeping people informed and creating perception that he's moderate and he's competent and things like that. So I think he's a shoo-in, and his nomination should be confirmed as early as next week, if not the following week.
I would tend to agree. You know, as an add-on for that, Lael Brainard being nominated as vice chair. There's a lot of pundit chatter that this is, you know, a nod to some progressives in the Democratic Party, and that she might actually bring things like climate change and sort of equitability in the financial world, even as far as innovations on cryptocurrency. How much impact does the vice chair have? And do you anticipate any, you know, serious changes to the financial structure if Dr. Brainard gets that vice chair role?
It's a good interpretation to view her as a nod to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. A lot of progressive Democrats are not happy with Chairman Powell. They may vote for him, but you know, some may not. But they don't think that he is aggressive enough, things like climate change and racial equity issues. So clearly packaging Powell with Brainard was a move to kind of placate progressives in the party. Lael Brainard is kind of a longtime Washington hand. She is well known to senators and the members of the House. She too will get some bipartisan support, but her vote will be much, much closer. And it's primarily because of this role she's in. She will be the Fed governor in charge of regulatory and supervision. And that basically puts her in the driver's seat to regulate the biggest banks. And this is a very, very important position, especially to a firm like ours. We are regulated by multiple federal regulators, but our primary regulator is the Fed. So she will be in the driver's seat in crafting new rules, new regulations, how tightly we should be regulated. And as you might suspect, in Republican administrations, the regulation may be a little more relaxed, and in a Democratic administration, the regulation may be a little more, maybe a little stronger. And both present different challenges. And my guess is that Brainard will be a regulatory activist to some degree, particularly in the climate change area. So she will insist that big banks be more precise in how they disclose risks relating to climate change, to the makeup of their boards, the makeup of their companies, the racial breakdowns of employees in the companies, and then other ways that banks are regulated. So I think you'll see an overall tightening of regulation of the biggest banks. That'll be something we will see unfold over the next couple of years. It won't necessarily be immediate, but it'll be a dynamic that will kind of evolve over the next couple of years. But her nomination and her approval, which I think is also imminent, is really important. And it's kind of one of these quiet jobs that people don't always think of as important. Any Fed governor position is important, but she's basically the number two person behind Powell at the Fed in terms of strength and power. And it's not even close. She has a very important role in overseeing other federal agencies to kind of craft and write the new regulatory regime for bigger banks.
I'm not going to ask you to be an equity analyst and see if that's going to be impactful on the expenses and earnings of these banks, but we do have just a few more minutes left, and I can't let you off the phone without, you know, trying to get some handicapping from you on the midterm elections and ask, you know, at this point, what does your group see as the most important contests out there? And do you see a major shift in power between Democrats and Republicans in November?
Yeah, as of today, we're a little less than 300 days away from election day. We're really about 250 days away if you take into account early voting, which will happen in some states as early as late September. So the election is not that far away. Looking at President Biden's standing with the public and just the general momentum of politics leads us to believe that Republicans will likely have a big year in the midterm elections unless things change significantly by summer. Really, if President Biden and Democrats are going to turn the tide and regain momentum, they really need to do it by the summer since many perceptions among voters set in. You have early voting in late September. So they don't have till election day. They really have until late September to turn the ship around. It can be done. We could see improvements in the pandemic. We could see other things that Americans love, and maybe Biden will get back to a 50% approval rating. But if he stays in the 40 percentile, especially in the low 40%, then Republicans are going to win big in November. They'll certainly win the House. We project right now they'd win about 25 seats. Democrats have an advantage of only 4 seats. So the net would be is that Republicans would have a majority of about 21 going into next year. In the Senate, it's 50-50. But Republicans are at somewhat of a disadvantage because some of the members they have representing swing states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, North Carolina, are retiring. And while those members would have been strongly favored for reelection, it's tough for other Republicans to win. So it's like in Pennsylvania in particular, you asked about races, that Senate race, the Senate race in Ohio, the Senate race in North Carolina, popular Republican senators are leaving those offices. And the person who will try to replace them from the Republican side are not as well known. They're not as well liked. Democrats have a chance of winning those seats. So if Biden stays in the low 40 percentile, then Republicans will have a chance to get a majority in the Senate. But if Biden moves up and gets into the high 40s, then I think that the Senate will likely stay in Democratic hands, although the margin will be about the same. It'll be 50-50 or 51-49, something like that. Not close enough for Democrats to have close to 60 votes, which is what they need to pass mess legislation. So I think next year we'll have a split Washington And that means a White House with a Democrat in office and at least one chamber of the Congress in Republican hands. So not a whole lot of optimism about legislation passing unless for some reason they all get drink the bipartisan Kool-Aid and, you know, want to enact a bipartisan agenda.
I think the bipartisan Kool-Aid is in fairly short supply these days, so I don't know if that's going to be featured at the party or not. And then really put you on the spot, presidential election, does Biden run? Is there talk of a change? If his approvals are so low, I guess the midterm elections will have something to do with that. And then, you know, we do have like, you know, 2.5-3 years before we have to really worry about that, I guess.
Yeah, it's a longer term thing that's always fun to look at. My guess is that Biden will not run and Kamala Harris will not run. And you'll have 2024 will look a lot like 2020 in that on the Democratic side, you'll have 15 or 17 candidates. And on the Republican side, you'll probably have 10 candidates. You'll have a lot of candidates running. In my view, it will be wide open. It's not clear, you know, who will be favored or what will happen. It really depends what's happening in the country and our economy and just, you know, where we are fast forward a few years from now. It's hard to know that right now, but, you know, a lot could happen, but I think it will be wide open. And I've always thought that Trump would probably run again in 2024, but a lot of my colleagues in town, other kind of swamp inhabitants, other lobbyists here in town, who are close to the political system as well, most of them believe that he will not run. So I could be wrong. Maybe he won't run. I think he will, but a lot of smart people think he won't. It's unclear. Things are just so wide open, but I think it will be a pretty wide open race with a lot of different candidates to choose from, much like we've seen in the last couple of elections, especially in the 2016 election, where we had coming off the end of the Obama term, where we had a Democratic primary, wide open Republican primary, a lot of people running, so much so that some of the candidates never really were heard because there just wasn't enough oxygen in the room to cover them. And there were just too many candidates. We may see one of those situations again in 2024, in my view.
Well, hopefully we'll all be here to witness that. And, I want to thank you once again for spending some time with us. I also want to thank you. I know there's a lot of people on the call, and Tom Mantione, my partner, and I often talk about UBS's Political Action Committee and the access that allows us to have, and you and your team bringing senators and congressmen and congresswomen directly in contact with us, which is incredibly helpful. And the fact that you're giving that money equally to Republicans and Democrats, and we're keeping an open mind on these things is really helpful. So I want to thank you and your team for doing that for us.
Well, thank you, Andrew, and thank you for your support of that and for Tom's as well. And we really appreciate that.
I think it's just a tremendous differentiator. And again, seeing the number of people that are on the call and those who will listen to it on our podcast, you know, makes me, you know, this is definitely something that people really enjoy and, or maybe don't enjoy, but feel like they need to have the information. It's more of a security thing. Maybe you think it's more that, like that?
I think people pay attention in Washington. It's kind of like when you get into a traffic jam and when you inch up in line, you realize that there's a big, brutal, ugly accident. And when you go by it, you just have to look at it. And that's like Washington these days. It's not pretty, but you have to know what's going on, I think, because so much of it affects people. It's not pretty, not fun. It can be something that you can't stand, but people do pay attention. And my sense is that the more chaos that exists up here, the more people pay attention.
I know we do. So again, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much, John. If I can get you to commit to having another conversation with us in another, you know, 4 or 5 months, that would be great. And thanks to everyone who's joined the call. And everybody have a great day. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.